Today, Carissa has asked that I read from Mark 8, verses 31 to 38, and I'm reading from the NIV. My section in my Bible is titled, Jesus Predicts His Death. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed. And after 3 days, rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." And you know, Chris.
Good morning, everyone. So nice to see you. Really is a bit of a novelty. I remember last week we came back in here, some of us, and the first time singing together, I was just like, oh, that's right, that's what this is like. So I have been very very excited to see you all, and hello to those on Zoom as well. But what I have not been excited about today is speaking to you about this passage. You might love this passage. Well done. Let's chat later. It might have some beautiful wisdom and some deep meaning in your life. I just don't like it. To the point where I have been joking all week that I was going to title this message, All the Things I Don't Like About Mark 8. And in the end, that's what I've titled it. It's got a parenthesis after it, but I'll tell you that later. Though I may not like this verse, it has definitely been juicy to wrestle with over the week. And so, what I would like to do today is share with you some of the things I have been grappling with in this verse, some of the things I have been learning about it, and offer you some things that you might like to chew on as well over the next week or so. As Mary said, we're in preparation for Easter. So, why not pick a passage that requires a little bit more work? But I'll warn you, it might do a number on you. In fact, I think that might be the purpose of this little passage. So I'm going to read it again in some slightly different language. I'm going to read from the Message translation. So feel free to read along if you like, or feel free maybe just to listen and see a slightly different take on that same message. And I'm also going to read from slightly earlier than where Michael started. So I'm going to read from Mark 8, verse 27 onwards. And interestingly, in this version, the title of that section is The Messiah. So here we go, Mark 8 from verse 27. Jesus and his disciples headed out for the villages around Caesarea Philippi. And as they walked, he asked, "Who do the people say I am?" Some say John the Baptizer, others say Elijah. This is what the disciples are telling him. Still others say that you're one of the prophets. So then Jesus asked, "And you, who do you say I am?" And Peter gives the answer and he says, "You are Christ, the Messiah." And Jesus warned them to keep it quiet, not to breathe a word of it to anyone. And he then began explaining things to them. "It is necessary that the Son of Man proceed to an ordeal of suffering and be tried and found guilty by the elders, high priests, and religion scholars, be killed, and after 3 days, rise again, alive." He said this simply and clearly, so they couldn't miss it. But Peter grabbed him in protest. Turning and seeing the disciples wavering and wondering about what to believe, Jesus confronted Peter. "Peter, get out of my way. Satan, get lost. You have no idea of how God works." And then calling in the crowd to join his disciples, Jesus said, "Anyone who intends to come with me has to let me lead. You're not in the driver's seat. I am. Don't run from suffering. Embrace it. Follow me and I'll show you how. Self-help is no help at all. Self-sacrifice is the way, my way, to saving yourself, your true self. What good would it do to get everything you want and lose the real you? What could you ever trade your soul for? If any of you are embarrassed over me and the way I'm leading when you get around your fickle and unfocused friends, know that you'll be an even greater embarrassment to the Son of Man when he arrives with all the splendor of God, his Father, with an army of the holy angels. So I wrote down some of my immediate reactions to this passage, and here's a few. Jesus, we've had a bit of a year, and I don't think I've got it in me to pick up my cross and die to anything, which is the language you will find if you're reading along in an NIV or another version. Jesus, why would you call Peter Satan? Jesus, this sounds exhausting and a bit harsh. So that's where I started with this, and I did some thinking over the week when I realised that I couldn't avoid speaking about it. I did some reading and listening and thinking and praying and hearing what other clever people thought about this and how they had made sense of it. And I'm sorry, but I didn't find all the answers for you. I did find some very intriguing, challenging, maybe even inspiring things that got me wondering more about this, what it meant at the time Jesus said it and what it might mean today to us who are reading it. So wherever you're at, I invite you to do the same thing, to sit with or wrestle with or be curious with God about what's in this verse, what challenges you from it, what it means in your life today. And this message isn't about what you need to go and do after reading this, but it is about what you might be inspired to think about. So, for a bit of context, when we get to this part of Mark's blockbuster, and I like to read his Gospels like a blockbuster because Mark is go, 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 Jesus did this, Jesus did that. When we get to this part in Mark's blockbuster Gospel, we have just come from a scene where Jesus feeds 4,000 people with a couple loaves of bread and a few bits of fish. He miraculously feeds them because he loved them and he was worried about them going hungry because they had been following him and listening to him for days. So we go from that scene, and then Jesus heals a blind man on the road. He puts his hands over his eyes twice and the man can see again. And then we get to this exchange with the disciples where they have this intense realization that Jesus is the Messiah, this long-awaited, long-prophesied about, waited for hundreds of years by their people, Messiah. And I think that helps give a bit of context to some of the language that comes in this passage. This is a big deal. Mark is serious about this, and so was Jesus. So he has this exchange with his disciples, but kind of like the blind man who Jesus has just healed, and he put his hands on the man's eyes twice before he could see fully. We kind of see the disciples are just, they're seeing it a little bit, but not fully. They maybe need a bit more healing, a bit more guidance before they're going to get this full picture. Because especially Jesus' revelation about the fact that he is the Messiah doesn't fit their ideas of what a Messiah should be. It doesn't fit their hopes and dreams and their plans for this Messiah. So when we get into the passage, we hear this phrase, he then began to teach them. Or he began to explain things to them. And in Mark's writing, that's a technique he uses to show that Jesus is going into some kind of deeper level of teaching with the disciples. We see it at a couple points on their journey with him that he goes, okay, guys, you've leveled up. Now let's talk about the next thing. And this is a big thing that he is teaching them. The disciples had left everything to follow Jesus, and they were probably excited about this young rabbi speaking amazing things, doing these incredible healings. They wanted to follow him. But Jesus knows that his time with them is short, and he knows where his mission is going to take them, and that the disciples are not prepared for that yet. So in this scene with them, Jesus doesn't speak a parable. He doesn't talk in metaphor. He just lays it out real clear, no sugarcoating, so that the disciples can start to come to terms with or to understand what is actually going on here. Mark says he spoke plainly about this. And what does he speak plainly about? Well, that the Son of Man, referring to himself, Jesus, would have an ordeal of suffering, would be tried, found guilty, by the leaders of the day, by the leaders of their religion, and be killed. And after 3 days, rise up again. Now, sometimes we read this and I often bump on this idea that it is necessary that Jesus will do this, or some translations say he must, or other words like that. And I think it can be easy to read this and just go, oh, yeah, that's what Jesus came to do. He's got to go do that. When you stop to think about it, this idea that Jesus, God sent Jesus to earth to be born and grow up and walk in a straight line and get on a cross and have this horrible stuff done so that he could die and rise again and tick a box. It's just missing something. It's not the whole story. And when we do look at the whole story of Jesus' life on earth, what we see is that the truth is a little bit more than this. Jesus' commitment to his mission to heal and love and save people, all people, not just people like his disciples who had a very clear idea that they were part of a special group that the Messiah was here for. Jesus' mission was bigger than that. And it was a mission so strong that he would pursue it even to death. And by pursuing these things, this path that he was on, it was going to put him into deadly conflict with the rulers of the day, with the superpower that oppressed his people, but also with the leaders of his own faith tradition. And Jesus knew that. He knew that this is where the path would go, but he also knew that he wouldn't waver. And so when we hear things like, it is necessary, or I must, it's Jesus saying, I'm here to love you. I'm here to save you. And nothing will get in the way of that. And so this is where we're going to end up. This is where things are going to come to a head. Now, keep in mind that in the same breath that Jesus is saying all this stuff to his disciples, he also tells them that he's going to rise again. But you may notice that bit just goes straight over their heads at this point. They're really not fussed about this claim. No one brings it up. No one says, hey, Jesus, what's that about? They've just missed it completely because they're so stuck on this idea of Jesus describing himself as a Messiah who was definitely going to die, who was going to be ridiculed and shamed and persecuted. And the reason they were so stuck on that is that they had hundreds of years of conditioning telling them what a Messiah would be. Peter, who pulls Jesus aside because he has such a gut reaction to these words, he comes from a tradition that said a Messiah would free them all from oppression, literally overthrow the superpowers who oppressed them. And so Peter was probably picturing scenes of revolution like we've seen on the news or like you've learned about at school, where literally governments and powers are overthrown and the people are free and it's a new, fresh start. That's probably what Peter had in mind. So when Jesus talks about being a Messiah who's going to die, this is rocking Peter's worldview. And his reaction is to say, Jesus, no, rein it in. A humiliating, violent political death is not what Peter had in mind for his Messiah. Maybe it's not how we like to picture our Messiah either. So then we have this line, which is one of the things I really dislike about Mark 8. Jesus has this response to Peter that is really harsh and direct, and he says, get behind me, Satan. You don't have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. And this language really startles me. I'll be honest. I don't know if you have the same reaction, but I'm like, whoa, Jesus, that's full on. It's taken me some time to sit with it and wrap my head around it, and I still am. But the point I'm at now is that this is an example of how serious Jesus is about what he's here to do. And it's an example of Mark trying to explain to the people reading his gospel that this is real. This is serious. There's no time to use any other words but very direct, very strong language. Jesus is so clear about what he's here to do, and he's chosen this moment to teach his disciples, and he doesn't want to leave them in any doubt. And so he calls out Peter. He calls out Peter's response because it is a really human moment. Peter is reacting just like we all would, and Jesus is trying to take his disciples a little bit past that, try to open their minds a little bit. But it's not easy. because they want to hang on to their ideas. Jesus is moving past those ideas, though. He's moving past their traditions, their reality, and he's talking about the realm of eternity and a love so strong that it's going to defeat death. So if I were to put this into the Australian Revised Translation, maybe we could tone it back, make it a little bit more laid-back Aussie, and maybe Jesus would say to Peter, knock it off, Peter. You've got the wrong end of the stick. You're talking like the evil one, and you're just showing that you don't know yet how God works. We then move on in this story, and Jesus calls in a crowd to listen to what he says next. So this little bit's kind of been a private exchange with his disciples, but now he invites in the people who were probably traveling, following, waiting for Jesus to, you know, give some excellent inspirational speech, and this is what they get. And in drawing in this extra crowd of people, it's maybe almost showing that this message that Jesus goes on to share is not just for his inner group, it's not just for the disciples, it's actually for anyone who wants to hear it, anyone who's curious about what it means to follow Jesus. So he addresses the crowd and he says, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. And he goes on. And Jesus just won't stop saying hard things in this passage. I think the thing I really dislike about this part of Mark is that it seems too hard. It seems to be describing a kind of faith, super faith, intense discipleship that I'm just not cut out for. I might like to pretend I am, but I know I'm not. And that's difficult because it makes me think, well, am I not good enough to be the kind of disciple that Jesus wants? Can I follow Jesus if I feel like I don't know how to take up my cross? I'm too tired to try to die to the things in my life that make me feel good and give me energy, even if I know that they're not the best. What does this mean? So I reread this passage over and over, and I read what other clever people have thought and read about it. And to be honest, I never read a perfect explanation that made me go, yep, right, done. But I did think of some things. I did have a few little moments of, okay, that's interesting. And I thought I might share them with you in case they're similar things or in case they encourage you to read through this and have your own moments of challenge, moments of inspiration. I'm not quite sure what to call them. Anyway, after sitting with this for a little while, the first thing that I sort of realized is that I think I read my own inner voice into this instead of maybe just reading Jesus' voice. Maybe some of you know this voice. It's the one that tells you, oh, you didn't do that very well. Yeah, pick up your cross. Good luck. When was the last time you did a sit-up? Maybe you've got a little voice in your head that likes to tell you, these are all the reasons you can't be that kind of disciple. And I think when I read it, I was reading it with a bit of that voice. That's not very helpful, exegesis, just a tip. try reading it in Jesus' voice in the time and place when he was speaking to the disciples first, and then maybe dig into what it might mean for you today. So anyway, I realized that I could peel off a layer of judgment in those words that Jesus did not put there, but I did. Jesus didn't speak these words as a rebuke or just to set a high bar because he's that good. He spoke them in truth. And that's the second thing that really stood out to me after sitting with this passage for a while, is that Jesus loved his disciples. He loved the people following him and listening in the crowds. And he loves me. He loves us. And he loves us enough to be honest with us about what a life of following him might look like. It's not a hard life just for the sake of it. When we deliberately decide to live in step with him, to walk his path, when we decide to believe his promises, when we decide to play a role in his mission, we often bump up against other things in this world that are not in step with that. We're going to bump into things that do not align. And so there is an element of struggle, an element of discomfort, and a call to some perseverance if we want to follow God. There is also incredible purpose and hope and joy and comfort and encouragement in following God. And one more thing that stood out to me after I had sat with this passage for a little while is that it reminds me of the hardship and the struggle that Jesus went through willingly for me, for his disciples, for all his followers, for all of us. And nothing could describe it better than Bill's prayer earlier. Jesus went through that fast. And I can read this passage again and I can almost hear him describing those things to me that he went through because he loved me. And I hear him explaining that following him might bring some echoes of the same stuff. I'll probably never be called to go through what Jesus went through. But following him might involve some discomfort, might involve some ridicule, might involve some disagreements. As he spoke to that crowd and his disciples in this passage that we read, this passage that I dislike so much, Jesus is being real. He's not being a shiny celebrity promising a get salvation quick scheme or a cushy life where you do A, B, C and tick, you're a disciple, you get a pay rise and it's all good. Other messiahs promise that. Other messiahs still promise that. But Jesus is being deliberately, excruciatingly honest about what it might mean to walk his path that turns everything upside down, that brings to earth a kingdom that makes no sense but is the most wonderful thing. And also, Jesus walked this path first. He walked the hardest and the worst version of it so that all of us who follow him might walk that path with the hope and joy of knowing what is at the end, not death, but life. So maybe, after all of this, maybe one of the reasons that I don't like Mark 8 is that it does pull a mirror up and it asks me, as I read it now, as I think about what it might have meant back then, but also what does it mean to me today to read this? It pulls up a mirror and it asks me to confront my deep love of self-reliance. And it asks me to think about how often that healthy self-reliance tips over into something else, maybe more like self-centeredness or self-serving or selfishness, something that tips a little bit off that path, away from what is healthy and to something that doesn't really look like a discipleship path of Jesus. Because if I really want to follow him, at some point I have to let him lead. That was a good line, Jesus/Mark. I think about Peter. Peter was so excited to follow his Messiah teacher. I know who you are, God. You're Christ the Messiah. He was so excited until Jesus told him where the path was actually going, and then Peter wasn't so sure. And I get that feeling. So maybe what this passage gives us today is a whole bunch of questions. Are we willing to follow when Jesus leads us to a place where we might need to swallow our pride and not hold on so tightly to our reputation? Are we willing to have a conversation with Jesus about what it means to die to things in our life that might get in the way of tasting a fullness of life with him? Are we willing to die to our instinct for self-reliance and self-preservation? And what does that look like for each of us? Because it's different. Are we willing to step into a life where we will be uncomfortable as we try to have faith in a world that likes to tell us that's pretty silly? And as I pondered these questions and I pondered my initial reaction to this passage, I come back to this question that I often ask when I realize that I'm a bit stuck on a verse and I don't like it. And I think the reason that I don't like it is it makes me wonder this thing, which is, do I know this Jesus do I know this Jesus who said that really awful thing to his friend Peter? Do I know this Jesus who seems to talk about this really intense path of following him? And yes, I do. I do know this Jesus, because this Jesus who tells me to take up my cross is the same Jesus who tells me tenderly to take his yoke and learn from him. The Jesus who calls us weary and burdened souls, offering us rest because his yoke is easy and his burden is light. This Jesus who has compassion when I feel like I can't follow him in the way that I should. This life of following Jesus is real and it's raw. And sometimes we take up our crosses and sometimes we take on Jesus' yoke. And when you say it out loud, you realize maybe they're not actually two different things. Someone cleverer than me can give that message. But if we are called into this adventure of a life following Jesus, believing that something bigger is going on than just what we can see, then I think we are called to wonder at these things, to have this conversation with God, to ask Jesus to show us, what does it mean now in my life, in our lives, to follow you, Jesus? What does it look like to be your disciple and to walk your path? And will you help me do that? And we know that he will. We know that he will help us. And that's where I want to leave it today, because from all of Scripture, from Jesus' story, from his movement in our own lives and our own experiences, we know that Jesus loves us and that it was and it is his mission to love us into wholeness, to love us all the way to the cross and into the grave and beyond into eternity. I think Mary put it really well. I can't remember the exact words, but it was something like this: unstoppable, never giving up kind of love. And that is good news. That is really good news. As we follow along this path as a church, this path leading us to the cross and to Easter time, we thank God for this good, good news. So the title that I gave my message, All the Things I Don't Like About Mark 8, the rest of it is in parentheses, and all the things I might learn from it. Thanks very much. I'm going to hand you back to our lovely worship team.